It's not. I don't choose my food on sturdiness.
Well, if you're going to dunk it into hot liquid, you'd want a sturdy biscuit, wouldn't you?
I want some flavour in there as well. I think you know if you're looking for your top dunker, I think you got to go ginger nut, haven't you?
Yeah.
Problem with a hobnob is you get a bit of flotsam and jetsam from it, don't you?
Yeah, and then it becomes, are you the sort of man that would, you know, scoop up bits at the bottom of your tea? I would probably suggest that you are, but I'm definitely not.
Certainly not.
Do you do that, John?
Certainly not. No. I mean, that's turns my stomach, that, the bits at the bottom. I would, if I had a chocolate digestive and there was a bit of smearing on the side of the mug, I'd go for that.
No, I'd throw it out.
Throw the mug out?
No, just give it a wash immediately. If there was chocolate smeared all over it, no thanks.
You know, sometimes you get a bit of a skid mark on the side of the mug.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really understand why you're talking about smears and skid marks when you're talking about biscuits. It's not massively appetising, is it?
Not appealing, no.
No, I'm just painting a picture.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah.
Vividly.
Mm. Got brown mugs at home, John, or
I have now.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
So what happens when you have two games where both teams have very little to play for? 12 goals, a red card, hopefully no injuries, and a 35-year-old veteran taking up his position between the posts. The focus might be on the Champions League final in a couple of weeks' time, but in the meantime, we've had some pretty entertaining football to tide us over. On this week's Blue Moon Podcast, we'll look back over the key moments of the games with Newcastle and Brighton, and look ahead to another dead rubber against Everton. But fans are back in the Etihad for that one, and there's a trophy presentation to look forward to as well, so it's not all bad. I'm David Mooney, with me this week is the Daily Mail's Jack Gorn.
Hello, mate. You all right?
I'm not too bad, thanks. And Goal.com's Jonathan Smith.
Hello, chaps.
So let's start off with, the first place I want to start with these games, because you can't look back over them in kind of a normal way with the way that the season's been going, the way that the season's gone and the way these two games have gone. And there's one talking point that I wanted to focus on, and it isn't Scott Carson, everybody, so sorry about that. But Jack, Ferran Torres, he scored a hat-trick, his first City hat-trick against Newcastle. And then I felt, very unlucky to be taken off against Brighton with the red card and the reshuffle that was needed. So what's this week done for him at City?
It's a good question, actually. He looks like a confidence player to me. We've not spoken to him because of the pandemic, so we haven't really got any... Don't really know what he's like as a personality yet, but the way Pep talks about him, it does feel as if he is a confidence player, which is obviously quite common in the positions that he plays. I thought I went to the game at Crystal Palace the other week. I thought it was quite a big afternoon for him because he looked a bit more robust and he did a lot of good work defensively. That the players on the bench, because it was basically the first team on the bench, they really appreciated it and were celebrating his tackles like they were goals, and that felt like quite an important moment for him. That it was almost as if he was not finally accepted, but some of them went, all right, okay, this lad's got a bit about him, sort of thing. And then the finishes at Newcastle were excellent, but it's the sort of thing that you expect from him, having watched him get his proper chance in the Champions League in the group stages. And he's obviously a very, very good finisher, has an eye for goal. And when Pep talks about him, he often kind of gesticulates about him, and his smell for goal and his nose for goal, which you can always tell with Pep what he thinks about a player from his body language, I always think. And when he talks about him inside the box, he's always effusive in his praise. So I don't know. It'd be interesting, because I've not actually been that impressed with him when he's played in his natural position this season. But then you almost want to give him like a little bit of a free pass this year, because he's been in and out of the team. It's the first year away, you know, in a foreign land. He's been away from his family. His sister's been over a little bit, but he's just not had that kind of I guess, like, unit around him to fall back on when things haven't been going his way.
And it's not, I mean, it's not easy to settle in the best of circumstances anyway, but in a year where, you know, travel's been difficult and, you know, the pandemic has had the effects it's had, I guess it makes it harder as well. John, I mean, let's talk about that hat-trick, because the finishes were fantastic, weren't they?
Yeah. But it was interesting. I wasn't at that game, so I was watching, I think it was on Sky, was it? Was it on Sky?
I can't remember. One of the two.
But I think it was Andy Cole was sort of talking about how he has that. He seems to stand in the right position, and I think Pep also mentioned it after the game. He did that thing where he sort of shuffles his fingers and in front of his nose and says he's got the sense of goal. He's got the smell of goal, and I think you could sort of see that in the way in all those goals against Newcastle. You know, he's the first one's a bit of an awkward height, so he's readjusted himself. Got a shot off on target. It turns out actually to be a fantastic little flick. So that's a great one. The second one was a good finish as well. And the third one, he's standing in the right place. So it's kind of, you know, for a winger, he seems to have that instinct for a goal, which is always it's always going to help you. You know, it's probably, like you say, it's been a difficult season for him. But also, if you look back at some of the signings in recent years under Pep, you know, when you think of Cancelo and Rodri, Mahrez, perhaps, that first season has been difficult. Yeah. So maybe next season, he's still only 21. So next season is probably the big one. I just thought it was a shame what happened at Brighton that he didn't get his opportunity. Because another thing that Andy Cole said was, you know, he was looking at him and saying, well, in a Champions League final, if you need a goal, if City need a goal and they're chasing it, Torres is perhaps the first substitute to come on, which I thought was, you know, with Sergio Aguero, who's probably going to start on the bench, would be a bit of a crazy decision, really. You know, Aguero's obviously done it for 10 years. But if he could have done, you know, if he could have gone into that Champions League final with a bit of momentum, then he, you know, that I think that's a kind of a realistic option. But as it is, he's got that hat trick against Newcastle in a game which was kind of a bit throwaway, really, from City's point of view. You know, playing Scott Carson, playing Eric Garcia from the start, it's like they weren't taking it completely seriously a couple of days after winning the title. He got the hat trick. If he'd have got another couple against Brighton, maybe got half an hour against Everton, suddenly that all changes. But perhaps his season is maybe, you know, it's kind of ended already.
Yeah,
we'll have to wait and see.
I mean, the interesting part of all of this, Jack, is I mean, credit where it's due. I've got a shout out to MV on Twitter who sent this in before the Newcastle game. Do you think Torres could be converted into a number nine? I think his movement and finishing are very good. And then after the Newcastle game, Mike Cook got in touch to say, should Torres be considered as the nine next season and Jesus as the winger? Personally, I think Jesus can play left, right, and central, but Torres is much more clinical in front of goal. I think Torres could be a 20 goal a season striker, whereas Gabby will always be 10 to 12, whether he's central or wide. And it does kind of, like, you look at Jesus' struggles this season and the problems that he has sometimes being that clinical striker. Torres has had much fewer opportunities this year and has found the net quite often.
Yeah, but he's also had fewer opportunities in lesser games and in games that aren't deemed quite as important. I think what John was saying about Torres was completely right, in that he will just stand still and he'll wait for the ball to come to him. I think that is the sign of a very good striker, and that's the sort of thing that Sterling had a year ago. That's what Sterling was doing. I think Jesus and Torres are slightly different in the sense that I think Jesus should be converted to a left winger permanently, because I think we said before, haven't we, that he's played some of his best games out there, particularly Real Madrid last season. I thought he was exceptional. Whereas Torres, I think you can just play Torres, because he's like he's 3 or 4 years younger or whatever it is. I think you just play him wherever at the moment, and wherever there's a hole that needs filling off the bench, then he just plays, and it's all about kind of getting the games in him rather than pigeonholing him as a nine. But he's quite a good option to have, because whatever they do this summer, clearly they want to sign a striker. And if they were to move Jesus wider, or maybe Jesus doesn't kind of remain at the club, then Torres has ample ability in the 18-yard box to be able to cover any shortfall in goals.
Yeah, I mean the thing is though, Jack. Obviously, the news over the kind of last few days or so has been Harry Kane wanting to leave Spurs. Do you see City going for him and kind of keeping Torres as a winger sort of thing?
Well, they're going to go for a big striker. Like Haaland was the first choice. Now Dortmund have always said that Haaland's going nowhere. But I mean, I said this to John loads of times on the phone over the last few weeks. It's like Dortmund will say that Haaland's going nowhere until someone coughs up the money that they're willing to part with him. So it kind of depends on how high any of the clubs that are interested in him, how high they want to go. And the same can be said for Kane. I really don't know what good value is anymore. Because of the pandemic, but also because of the escalating prices across Europe pre-pandemic, I just don't know how much a 30, 35 goal a season striker is worth these days. I don't know, maybe I'm being naive, I just can't see a club, I can't see Man City paying 130 to 150 million pounds for a striker, like particularly with Kane, like with the injuries. I'm struggling to see it.
Yeah, John, are you thinking that this could all affect City's thinking for a new striker in the summer as well? Given, I mean, if Torres could play centrally a bit more next season, they've done pretty well without a striker for most parts of this season.
I think it'll bring in a striker in the summer, but I think one thing I would say is that, you know, it's not like City play a left winger and a striker and a right winger for 90 minutes. You know, you can put Gabby Jesus at centre forward for 15 minutes, swap him over with Sterling, swap him over with Torres. You know, even in the process of an attacking move, they will switch positions. And it's an advantage to have people like that who are so flexible that they can... You know, there was a couple of moments against Newcastle where Gabby was sort of picking the ball up out wide and dribbling past fullbacks and midfielders, cutting inside like a, you know, like an Arjen Robben or something like that. So, you know, one thing we've seen this season, in the second half of the season, is there's so much flexibility in this City squad at the moment. You know, it's not like they've actually had they've been playing with a false nine, but who is that false nine? One moment it's Kevin De Bruyne, it's Bernardo Silva, it's Phil Foden, it's Mahrez, it's Sterling. They all do it at one point during the game. They start there at the start of a game, so it's an advantage for both of them that they have that flexibility. So I think, you know, that makes them, you know, a huge asset for Pep Guardiola.
Yeah, let's touch on the reason why Torres was taken off, though, against Brighton, Jack, because listening to Guardiola after the game, he didn't seem that impressed with Stuart Atwell and John Moss, the VAR. What did you make of the performance?
Well, Atwell's performance overall is just dire, nowhere near good enough. And it's funny when like people complain about VAR, it's almost like they're complaining about some electronic equipment, when actually, like, the VAR itself is fine and being able to look over decisions. Like, I don't really like it. I'd prefer it just to be a completely, like, just get rid of it. But I can understand why they use it. But they kind of still got the same idiots using it that are out in the field anyway. So, like, Moss in Stockley Park, terrible. Atwell, like, struggles to control football matches, gives ghost goals. I know that was about 15 years ago.
It still happened.
It'll stay with him because it's just a ridiculous thing to do. Look, you could go through loads of incidents from the game and just say he's got them all Just got them all wrong.
The red card especially, though. I mean, the red card, once he's given the foul against Cancelo, he has to send him off. And then the VAR has to... The only way they can say that it's an obvious error is if he shouldn't have sent him off. Well, he had to because he deemed it a foul. But so then the question is it a foul?
To be honest, I didn't have too much of a problem with it. I thought he misjudged the ball over the top, panicked, and just tried to disguise fouling Welbeck. I know most City fans didn't think that. So you know, I did tweet that out, and people pointed out to me that I was wrong on that one.
But as Twitter does sometimes.
But I mean, we don't want to turn this show into sort of moaning about VAR, but I'm not really sure what it's there for. It doesn't seem to make any. You know, you go back to the penalty that John Moss didn't give against Phil Foden. You know, what is VAR looking at there? There's just so many examples. You know, I mean, on the same night, that penalty, Chelsea versus Leicester. I mean, I don't know how you can miss these things just looking at the TV screen. And then it's also made worse when you're watching it on BT Sport when you get Peter Walton, who's basically, to be fair to him, he's doing only what the VAR doing, what the VAR official is doing, which is completely fudging making a decision.
Shilling for referees.
Well, when they go to VAR, they say, right, let's go to Peter Walton for his view. And he just fudges it, doesn't say anything, waits for VAR to make a decision. VAR generally agrees with the referee. Peter Walton then comes out and says, they've made the right decision. It's just the whole thing's just fudging it. No one's actually prepared to make any sort of forthright decisions. It's just pointless. You know, you also go back to the last minute penalty against Jesus. You know, at the time I thought it was a penalty, but I thought, the referee's seen that he's got the ball or something like that. VAR then gets involved, and then they don't give it. Just what complete waste of everyone's time.
Yeah, I mean the other incident, Jack, that Guardiola was unhappy about was the tackle on Gundogan. There are comparisons there with the one that John Stones was sent off for at Aston Villa, where the VAR looked at that and said, "Well, no, it's excessive force. A red card is the correct decision." And then the VAR looks at this one and says, "It's not excessive force." And so
the Stones one wasn't excessive force. It was a defender caught out of position who's just gone through everything, but it's not excessive force. It's just that was wrong in my view. And then the Gundogan, I mean, look at the still image of the Gundogan one. It looks terrible, doesn't it? And could have done him some serious damage. I guess Villa fans would claim the same with the Stones tackle. It's just, to be honest, David, I don't know what is a foul anymore. I don't know what offside is anymore. I don't know what handball is anymore. So you're kind of at the mercy of these people in Stockley Park, just kind of feels like they're guessing. Because there's no consistency, is there? That's the main thing. I mean, I think everyone can take bad decisions against their team. You know, like, if my team got a bad decision against them, you're kind of annoyed about it, but there's that old thing where it evens itself out over a season, which I don't think it does, but everyone kind of lives by that rule. But at the moment, it's just like, you watch one thing happen for Villa, and they'll give it, and then something will happen for Tottenham and they won't give it, and then Arsenal, they'll give it, and it's just completely baffled by it, and I don't really know how they come back from it, to be honest. I think they've gone so far down the road with VAR that they can't do a Yui.
Yeah.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
before we move on, I want to get this in from Barry Tiernan as well on Twitter, John. He asks, what's happened to Cancelo over the past few weeks? One bad game against Leeds seems to have destroyed his confidence. And as you said, as harsh as the red may have been, he could have dealt with that ball over the top a bit better. And he's looked a bit shaky in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I thought he was good against Newcastle. I thought that was a bit more the old Cancelo. Obviously, he scored. Yeah, I mean, he's had a fantastic season. I thought it's interesting. I thought a couple of months ago he was in with the shout of the Football of the Year. And then when it came to voting, he wasn't even in the equation. So that kind of gives an example of how his form has sort of disappeared a little bit. But, you know, the game against, I think it was Borussia Dortmund. Well, it was in Hungary, so I can't remember whether it was the first leg or the second leg. But he was so good in that. That's what he's capable of. You know, I don't think he's been that bad. A little bit of lost form, a little bit of lost confidence. But I think if he gets the call against Chelsea, which he may not do, I don't see it being a problem.
Yeah, someone else, Jack, who may or may not get the call against Chelsea is Rodri, because I mean the Trossard goal at the end of the Brighton game, did that show why Guardiola might turn to Fernandinho for the final?
I thought his reaction when he gave the ball away was awful. I don't know if you've seen it back from behind the goal.
He puts his hands on his head and stands still, doesn't he?
He shakes his head. Oh my God, what have I done? And doesn't like kind of. I know he's never going to get back into the box to affect the game, but you've got to make it look like you're trying. It's really strange, his reaction. But it's interesting, actually, because before that game, the guy, my colleague that was covering it for us that was at the match, texted me and said, oh, how many of these players are jockeying for positions for the Champions League final? So I was like, well, it's Zinchenko or Cancelo, you would have thought. And that was pretty much it. And then I'd forgotten about Rodri completely. And you probably... on current form, you probably play Fernandinho in a one-off game, I think. He's been so good when he's been called upon in the biggest games that I just can't envisage him not playing. For what he gives him, obviously in midfield and kind of breaking up the game, and like we'll all laugh about the fact it barely ever gets, well, it doesn't get the bookings that he deserves, maybe. but it's just the leadership and the, I think if you go into a game, a Champions League final like that, and you've got Diaz at the back, and you've got Fernandinho through the spine, and you've got De Bruyne further up the field, and you've got three leaders that are all joined up there that can kind of coach the others through difficult moments. And I think that would be my reasoning for playing Fernandinho in that game.
Yeah, John, the other name for that Champions League final for the big moments again could quite well be Phil Foden, couldn't it? You look at that goal against Brighton, he looked up, had nothing in the middle, so thought, sod it, I'll stick it in the bottom corner.
Yeah, it's just brilliant, wasn't it? Absolutely amazing. I think it kind of suited him with that particular goal that they were down to 10 men and he just didn't really have a lot of options. He was a little bit isolated and just thought, oh, let's just go for it. Let's just run. And they just couldn't stop him. And a clever finish. I think he's a must-starter against Chelsea. I mean, it's just... He just frightens everybody. Chelsea will be terrified of him. So, he has to start the Champions League final.
Yeah, Jack, the thing with Foden has been that this season he's really grown into that front three. And, you know, you can't argue that he deserves his place there, can you?
Yeah, well, no, you can't. No, he'd be one of the top three names on the team sheet for me. I think this season it's been about him taking responsibility a little bit more. And he seems to have kind of grown into the squad a little bit. And he's able to like moan at others when they don't give him the ball. And kind of, you know, if someone's got two options for a final pass and they don't pick him and he's obviously the best option, he'll tell them. Whereas this time last year, he wouldn't tell them. So he's got a bit more personality to his game now, and he's got a bit more of an edge, which I think has probably been spotted by the manager, that he's able to stand up to his teammates and the sort of people that for years and years he's watched and he's adored as a fan, and now he kind of can hold his own amongst them. And he's obviously just got his ability is absolutely insane. Like, people talk about generational talents and all that sort of stuff. There can only be one generational talent, and in England, it's Phil Foden. There is absolutely no doubt about it. He's the best young player that England have produced for a long, long time. And unlike some of the others, his goals and assists are like right up there. Whereas others kind of do look quite nice and they do bits and bobs in games, but Foden just actually gets on with it and he's the sort of player that could win England and City any game he wanted.
Yeah, well, obviously the Euros coming up as well, so it could quite well be a big summer for him. Let's look ahead to the Everton game on Sunday. We had an email in from Steve O'Brien who says, "I'll be honest with you, I don't like it when City play on either Friday or Saturday evening. After a hard week of work, this should be the time to relax, and relaxing through City matches is not something I generally tend to do. This week, I could finally tune in on Friday to a game that didn't matter, one I could simply sit back and enjoy like never before from this position. Then when seeing Pep's starting lineup, it seemed to matter even less. I mean, even last time we ran away with the league, there was the sole focus of 100 points and no other competitions to think about, except that the longer the match went on, and with each goal that was scored, I became increasingly aware that it did still matter to me that we win. Did you feel the same or not? I've thought about it since, and I think I just want to win the league by the largest gap we can fashion." So with that in mind, John, this is in theory a dead rubber, but there's a trophy presentation to come on, at the Etihad. There's 10,000 fans are going to be there. It feels like maybe a little bit more than a dead rubber, does it?
Oh, definitely. I'm looking forward to this one on Sunday. I've obviously been very lucky to get to all the games at the Etihad this season, and it's just not the same. So I was at the Carabao Cup final, and the fans made a massive difference for that. So and also at Brighton, I thought the atmosphere came across on the TV, and perhaps maybe influenced the referee a little bit with some of his decisions. So for that point of view alone. Absolutely one of the games I've been looking forward to more than any other. Trophy presentation, of course, is going to be special. Sergio Aguero's last game is going to be, kind of getting used to these, but then not getting used to these. Legends leaving all the time. Pablo, Vincent, and
Yaya. There's been one every year at the end of each of Guardiola's seasons. It's not the easiest thing to do, is it?
No, and David's last game was, not what he deserved to just walk off. Perhaps in some ways it suited him because that's the kind of player he was. He was quite happy to not take any of the limelight. But he deserved better than that, to walk off in an empty stadium, just clapping the substitutes and, a couple of officials and things like that. So it'd be great that Sergio gets some sort of a farewell. He also deserves a 60,000 capacity crowd there to say farewell. But and then last of all, this is an important build-up game for the Champions League. So last game before the Champions League. Okay, they relaxed against Newcastle. Took the foot off the gas. Brighton didn't go, it wasn't the preparation game that they needed. Although, they obviously had to work hard and it was a bit of a test in the end. But this is the one where, Everton are a decent side. They're not that far away from Chelsea. Chelsea obviously a lot better, but, still a good team. This is an opportunity to get everyone focused, hone everything, get the tactics right, and really start the countdown now for the Champions League final.
Yeah. Jack, what sort of team are you expecting? Is it going to be a bit of a mix of the team that will play in the final and a few, just to rest the legs? Or is there going to be anybody playing for the place? I mean, like that sort of thing?
I don't think there'll be any playing for places, will there? As I said before, I think Zinchenko or Cancelo is probably the biggest decision he's got to make. I don't know. I think he'd play pretty as close to full strength as he can do. I would have thought, purely because you've got, the 6 days before Chelsea. he always talks about, like, rhythm's one of his favourite words. He always talks about rhythm. So if you, you know, if you take him by his word there, you'd say, well, play a really strong team on Sunday, win the game, give Aguero a good send-off, lift the trophy, and then the kind of, they're ready for Saturday. Yeah. I don't know. I think if he makes loads and loads of changes and plays, not the B team, but plays those that are probably not in the best 11, it just has the potential to feel a little bit disjointed.
I kind of feel like this is the one week you don't want a disjointed game, isn't it?
No, I think they just want to go in like with a clean, go into Chelsea just with a clean win behind them, played well, scored some goals. Defended well. I think you need to defend well on Sunday because you can quickly get out of the habit of defending well as a team. And obviously they conceded three goals in the last two games. Just treat it as like game, I don't know, game 10 in the Premier League and one that you need to win. Is probably the best way to look at it because you can get distracted by things. As John said, they had the few days where they celebrated the win before the Newcastle game and kind of like turned up at Newcastle all like joking around and it was all a bit of a laugh at Newcastle, which you don't want to sound disrespectful, but that was mirrored in the team selection, particularly with the goalkeeper. And now it's time to kind of for them to get serious again. If they win on Sunday, they go into Chelsea in the right frame of mind.
Yeah, I mean, this is the sad thing, I think, John, is we're talking about Torres at the start of the show, and I feel like had Torres had a good game against Brighton and then gets named in the starting lineup against Everton and has another good game, he's one that could have played his way in at the last gasp to the final. But now with the way it kind of panned for him at Brighton having to be taken off and... The interesting thing about that Brighton selection was it looked like the Champions League final 11 with Torres in it instead, and that's it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. To be honest, I think it would have taken a lot for Torres to have forced his way into the starting 11 for the Champions League final. I think he'd have needed a couple of goals against Brighton and another couple against Everton to even be considered. I mean, not that Pep isn't beyond throwing an absolute shocker in there, and well, not a shocker, but you know what I mean,
a
surprise,
ball, yeah.
A curveball that we just don't see coming. He said plenty of times already in the build-up to this game, he doesn't know what his starting 11 is. Whereas I think, us three now could sit there and if we were to pick what we thought the starting 11 was, I think we'd probably all come up with the same names.
Yeah.
Obviously Kev's had a slight niggle, so maybe he comes in against Everton I don't think it will be his 11 that plays against Everton, but I think the 11 that start against Chelsea is the 11 that we all... I hope you think the same way as me, anyway.
Yeah, that's the other question I had, Jack, was obviously Gundogan had to go off against Brighton. De Bruyne has been carrying a little bit of an injury, nothing too bad we've been told so far. Do we know anything about their fitness ahead of this game? Are they likely to be involved at all, just to kind of get some minutes in the legs?
No, I've been off this week.
Fair enough.
You'd probably think De Bruyne... come off the bench, half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, or maybe start and then withdraw him early, just to get that kind of rhythm, you'd have thought. So, yeah, does he play Jesus again? Does he bring Jesus back in for Sunday? You'd presume that both De Bruyne and Gundogan wouldn't start. And Gundogan he's played quite a lot recently, hasn't he? So he'd probably be all right to have the weekend off.
But
De Bruyne is quite important. If he's fit enough to play Sunday, which I'm sure he is, then it's important to get some minutes in him.
Well, an absolutely bonkers week of games means we got no wins on last week's show. We now only have two chances to better the best ever total on the charity bet. We're currently on £1,185 for this season, and that's £165 short of our total from 2017, the end of Guardiola's first season. One game to predict on this week's show, Everton at home, and all the money is going to the Christie, a cancer treatment hospital in Manchester. William Hill is giving each of us a £10 correct score single. John, I said bring the crazy for this one because they've been a little bit unpredictable, the games recently. What have you gone for?
Oh, sorry, I've gone a bit boring. I've gone 3-0.
Well, if it comes off, it's not boring if it comes off, mate. So 3-0 is 17-2 and £85. Jack, what are you having?
Even more boring, 2-1.
2-1 is 7-1 and £70 if you're right. I decided to kind of push the boat out a bit and go 4-2, which if I'm right is 35-1 and £350. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. Please gamble responsibly. You can find out more by going to begambleaware.org.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
Now, this season hasn't been like any ordinary season, and that might make City's achievement of winning the title in strange circumstances all the better. I've been speaking to the Times journalist Paul Hurst to look at the key moments of where this title was won.
You look at him now, and like you say, he's a bit kind of... He's very relaxed and very... you know, calm now, isn't he? And I just think that's partly because he's had 5 years, A, in this city, and B, with this team. I think if you look at the squad, you know, most of that squad has been there for the entirety of his 5 years, I'd say. You know, people like Gundogan, Sterling, De Bruyne, etc. They're a bit more kind of a settled unit, and they have been for the last 5 years. So I think that's contributed to his calmness. I think his relationship with Khaldun is better than ever, so that's helped him become a lot more kind of relaxed and zen-like, really. So I think those are the main reasons why he's a lot more settled this year than he has been in the past.
Yeah, I mean, you look as well, when he's talking about the title celebrations from Tuesday, I mean, this is what he said, but even about how things were behind the scenes, it feels so much more relaxed, as you say.
We drink a little bit, we dance, we hug a lot, we remember how good it was, and especially at 11:30, 12, arrived 10, 15 pizzas, and that was the best moment of the night. Here in England, the party is always just alcohol, it's not food, I don't understand why, so... And the moment Mark decided to bring the pizzas was perfect.
I mean, when you listen to him talk like that, it feels so much more relaxed, doesn't it?
Yeah. This is... I love that line about the pizzas and the English parties being all about boozing, basically. It must have been a nightmare for Pep Guardiola, you know, a guy who brings in a world-renowned nutritionist to kind of change their diets, the players' diets 5 years ago, and then end up having pizza and beer. You know, it's certainly kind of a change from the norm for him, that's for sure. But I think he's, you know, I think that's, you know, they are, you know, they were entitled to kind of celebrate, weren't they? And you know, it sounds like they had a quite a good knees up. So
yeah. I mean, just looking on the pitch, I mean, things got off to a slow start this season. Was that simply because of how close to the end of last season it had been, and kind of how little preparation time they'd had, do you think?
Yeah, I think that was a massive factor. I spoke to one source who was close to one of the senior players at City, and he was saying that he came back. When they came back, it was only like a few weeks after that Champions League defeat to Lyon, and that was still in his mind. You know, they couldn't really get away and go on a proper holiday. They didn't have a proper pre-season. I think if you look at those pre-season tours, I think they're always quite a good way of, you know, obviously signifying the start of a new season and making a clean break from the previous season. Whereas City didn't have one this year, obviously, because there was such a tight turnaround and because of the COVID restrictions on travelling. So they couldn't go away, they couldn't have a proper pre-season and think about what was, you know, get last year out of their system, basically. They just didn't have time to do that. So that was a bit of a hangover going into the start of the season. That was why they started off so poorly. or they're inconsistent at the start, weren't they? Because I remember watching that first half of the Wolves match and thinking, crikey, this is, you know, an exceptional performance. But then in the second half, they were just knackered. You could tell straight away they were just weren't match fit. So it was a lack of consistency at the start of the season that cost them. You would never expect them to draw a game against West Brom, would you? But now, you know, so that's it shows you what kind of a difference this City team is now compared to how they were at the start of the season.
Yeah, I mean, even the big kind of turning point really early in the season that a lot of people put down to is the signing of Ruben Dias. He's been fantastic throughout this year. How has his relationship with Stones helped John Stones develop as well? Because their partnership has been the one that's basically seen City to all those wins.
Yeah, I think the Stones and Dias partnership extends beyond the pitch. That they are friends off it. And I remember seeing like a YouTube video that City put out. I think it was sometime in the autumn of those two talking and like sharing jokes and stuff. And sometimes football clubs, when they put things like that out, videos out like that out, you think, oh, it's just a bit of a publicity stunt. They don't actually, you know, get on as well as they do, but they do. Those two are really, really close. And for Dias to have had such to build such a relationship with Stones in such a short space of time is pretty remarkable, really. I voted for Dias for Player of the Year just because he's given City something that they've not had for a couple of years, or since Vincent Kompany left. And because he's so good at defending, because he's got such a good partnership with Stones, then that gives Gundogan more confidence to get forward. It gives Foden more confidence to get forward as well. So it's all interlinked, really. A stronger defence gives confidence to the attackers. So I think his impact has just been it's been monumental, really.
Yeah, and you know, I feel a little bit for Phil Foden in a weird way because I mean he's had an exceptional season, but he's kind of gone under the radar a little bit in all the talk of how, you know, Stones has improved, how Dias has come in, even Mahrez has he's getting the plaudits, Gundogan as well, like you say. There was a nice little anecdote in your piece on the season about how Guardiola had managed Phil Foden with the Iceland incident, wasn't there?
Yeah, he. Foden is a huge England fan, you know. First and foremost, he'd always watch England games when he was, what to say, when he was a lad. He's still a lad now, but you know, when he was even younger. So when he got that first call up to the England squad, and he looked like when he was selected for the Iceland match, it was such a big thing for him. You know, he took a picture of his England shirt and he sent it to like his friends and family on the morning of the Iceland game, because he was so proud of that, the fact that he was going to represent his country. And then obviously it went downhill pretty fast from there, from after the match, with what happened with him and Greenwood. And he was kind of overwhelmed by the media reaction to it. So it was a really kind of, it hit him quite hard. But Pep, rather than hammer him in public, I think he probably knows that things like this do go on, you know, now and again in football. So rather than hammering him, he just put his arm around him and said, look, you know, it'll be all right. You'll be fine. We'll get through this. And that bit of advice, that bit of, you know, that arm around the shoulder meant a lot to Foden, from what I've been told. So he properly knuckled down after that. And like you say, his season's just been incredible, really. 16 goals, I think it is, he scored. So it's something that he wouldn't have expected to do at the start of the season after the start he had. So it's a credit to Foden for getting through that, and to Pep for his management, really.
Yeah, you mentioned the West Brom draw earlier on. That was the point at which Guardiola quite famously said that he didn't recognise his team. This is what he said about it recently.
We had a lot of COVID players, a lot of injured players, and we adjust the way we played more than the idea or the patterns, what we have to play, for the quality of the players that we're able to play. And you have to adjust some situations and the way we are playing that make me feel a little bit, okay, we win games, sometimes we draw, but I didn't recognize. So normally when I was in Barcelona, Bayern Munich, you could play good or bad or win games or lose games, but the pattern was there, always was clear the way we want to play. In that moment, I didn't know. I didn't recognize the team for the fact don't represent what I want. And after we reflect, I said, okay, come back, the A after B and after C, but start with the A. And A means something what we have done all the time, and it didn't work quite well in Southampton that we won because we won, but we didn't play so good. But after that, we continue to play better and better, winning games, and help us to get good mood, good confidence, and the rest came from himself.
What do you make of what he changed after that game, Paul? Because it was a performance where I watched it and thought City could play and play and play all night and they were just never going to get a shot away on target. And then suddenly, you know, 3 months later, they've put a 23-24 game winning streak together.
Yeah, it was. I agree with you. That year at that time in the season, I think even worse than that was the 0-0 draw at Old Trafford. You know, it was a really defensive sort of negative team performance at Old Trafford. And it's, you know, that is just not what you expect to see from City at all. So the 0-0 draw at Old Trafford, the 1-1 draw at West Brom were just the most uncharacteristic City Pep Guardiola performances that I've ever seen. And I think they just went back to basics after that, didn't they? They stopped. Because he's such a, you know, a demanding manager, I think the players probably want to, you know, impress him and try to do extra, you know, special things. When you know, City are at their best when they keep the ball. You know, that is the main thing. If City got the ball, you're going to struggle to get it off them, aren't you? Basically, because they're so good at passing. So I think they just went back to basics. Passed, made fewer runs, just became a bit more economical with the ball, and it's just as simple as that, really. You know, just stop making ridiculous runs that are not going to be picked out. You just keep it simple, really, and that was the root of the upturn in form that came just after that.
Yeah, and that was the time as well. We were all wondering, you know, that was the start of December, that West Brom draw. You know, Guardiola had signed his contract extension a month earlier. And, I mean, even at the time, I remember talking to City fans saying, well, he keeps saying that he has to prove himself and deserve his new contract. Well, I'm not seeing anything of that suggests that he does deserve his new contract at the moment, that he has proved that he's capable of changing things. And then obviously they go on that winning run and now it looks like one of the best decisions that they've made. This is what he said about whether that contract gave stability to the team.
When everybody knows the manager will be the next 1 or 2 or 3 years, that makes certain stability. Saying that, the contracts of the manager are so volatile because if you don't win, you'll be sacked. Listen, the players trust you, especially if you win. If you don't win, even if you are 1 month, 3 years, 5 years, they see weakness of what you have done. Even what we have done so far in the recent past, we won a lot. If you start to lose, they start to believe or they start to doubt about you.
So, Paul, did that contract extension actually help the turnaround in form, do you think?
Yeah, I think that was the biggest turning point of the season, Pep signing his new contract. You spoke to people for this piece that Paul and I wrote, and it was and they were saying that people were openly talking at CFA about who would replace Pep at the end of the season. You know, that was the, and that's only natural. You know, football clubs are, you know, they yearn for stability and kind of so if Guardiola isn't going to be there at the end of the season, they want to know who's going to replace him. So I think that contract extension was huge for the players. Just gave them a bit of clarity. You know, who's going to be here next season? Who's going to? It also gave the club, you know, stability in terms of who they're going to sign, because at the moment Pep Guardiola is a huge carrot for any player, you know, for it's a good reason to come to City. Obviously, they pay quite well, and you know, the success is there for everyone to see over the last few years. But if you don't know who's going to be a manager, it's pretty hard to sell, isn't it? You might not get on with that manager that's coming in. You might not like their style or whatever. So, I think that helps give the club a kind of stability across the board, not just in the squad, but in you know, in the rest of the club as well, in terms of transfer targets and kind of what comes next. So, yeah, I think it was a huge sort of relief for the club, I guess, for Pep to sign a new deal.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned before his relationship with Khaldun. He was asked about that recently as well. This is what he said.
I traveled to see him in November, and he convinced me that still we have a lot of work to do. And I said, the way he said to me, I said, okay, we're going to try it again in the next years. And part of the reason why my happiness here or success we had is but his determination to convince me to say, we still have to do it. That is the big difference. What I found, what I had the feeling in sometimes in other clubs and other, I would not say because I've always been supportive in Barcelona and in Bayern Munich, but I had the feeling that the manager always been supportive when you have success. And I cannot forget now my first season here, where I didn't win anything, the behavior of my chairman. And I cannot forget the big disappointment personally against Lyon, the support I had from my chairman. I saw he trusts me. I cannot assure him that success. I cannot assure anyone how it's going on. No one can assure it. I saw in his eyes. I saw in the way in our dinners together with the families and everyone. I saw he, I trust you, Pep. And it doesn't matter what happens, you have to do it. And that's why we decide there, okay, we're going to stay longer.
Now, was it that Khaldun had travelled especially to see Pep in the Maldives, or had they gone together, was it, to discuss the contract sort of thing?
Well, Pep certainly needed a holiday at that time. I think, you know, he was getting it towards his kind of wit's end, really. But the Khaldun had travelled there to talk business with him, and I think they both knew that business was on the agenda. You know, as Pep said there, they had a kind of a good heart to heart, really. And I think that wasn't the only time this season where he's had a heart to heart with him. He spoke to him after the West Brom game, and I think later in the season as well. So, you know, that was, you know, but that meeting in the Maldives was the kind of crucial. That was when Guardiola said, "Yeah, I will stay." And you know, their relationship now is more solid than it's ever been. When Pep came here, he came for Cheeky and Ferran because he obviously knew them from before. I think there was always a bit of kind of, you know, curiosity on Guardiola's part about how his relationship with Khaldun would be, because he'd, you know, he didn't really know him from before. He'd obviously met him before he signed the contract, but he was curious to see how it would go, and their relationship has been kind of one of the, it's been the kind of cornerstone of his success at City, that Khaldun has supported him. Like Pep said, after that first season, didn't win anything, asked him what he needed, went out and bought the fullbacks that they needed, and gave him support. And I always remember, I think it was a couple of years ago, yeah, it was the 2019 when City played Schalke. I remember being down in the mix zone after the first leg when City had won 3-2, and just seeing Khaldun come out of nowhere and give Pep a massive bear hug. It was just like, you know, he was so happy and delighted for him that they'd won, and that to me shows that they do have like a really good personal relationship. It's not just professional; they are friends off the pitch as well.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting aspect is Guardiola was talking recently about his backroom staff, and he was saying the support he gets from Khaldun and above him is also the same sort of support he also gets from his coaching staff and the people that help him. This is what I asked him about Juanma Leo recently, and this is what he said about the impact that Leo had had to the season.
Juan is a friend from a long time ago. I went to Mexico to be trained with him. I learned a lot being there as his football player. He sees something like I'm not able to see. He's an incredible optimistic, incredible. Always has ability, have two things. One is this one, optimistic. And the second one, never ever speak bad for another person, never. Normally in these groups, always the people when they start to lose games or not going well, always to find excuses to speak bad to the other one. Juanma is completely the opposite. Always see the positive things of the human being, always see the positive skills for the player, always sees you know, in the bad moments, always have the tendency to find how good is going to come in the next weeks, in the next month. Normally the manager will have a lot of pressure, all the managers knows it, for the media, for the decision, the players who play, the training, how do you have to do? And have this balance with Juanma helped me a lot, a lot. Personally, he have to say the right words in the right tempo to me, of course, to the players sometimes, what we need.
No, I like the line in your piece that basically said that Leo was able to say to Pep sometimes, you know, maybe you're not right about this.
Yeah, imagine being that guy, eh?
Yeah.
I think they are a really good combination because, A, there's the respect there, and B, they've got kind of different personalities that kind of match each other quite well. You know, Lilo, you can tell, is a calm guy. Whenever I see him on the bench, he's not all over the place. He's not shouting and bawling. You know, sometimes assistants, I think they get a bit carried away, you know, when they're on the touchline and kind of get, you know, start shouting and bawling at people and try and get involved. Whereas you see him, he just sits there and kind of waits for, let's Pep, you know, go on the touchline and, you know, do what he does on the touchline, if he's animated or not. And he just sits there and observes. And he's a really tactical kind of deep thinker, and you can tell that they work really well together. I mean, that tale about Guardiola going to play for him in Mexico for Dorados de Sinaloa just shows you how much respect Pep had for him and how much he kind of admired the way that he thinks about football and the tactical innovations that Lilo makes. I mean, Pep went out there, he was, you know, towards the end of his career, last club that he played for. I don't think his body wasn't up for it, but he went to Mexico to Sinaloa, which is, you know, it's hardly a kind of tranquil place. You know, it's associated with narco traffickers and et cetera. So he went out there, barely picked up a wage. I think there were moments where he didn't, you know, where he actually didn't get any money. And, you know, paid, I think he paid a few kind of fellow players a bit of money as well, Pep. And the only reason that he went over there was to learn from Lilo.
Yeah.
You know, in this crummy 3-star hotel, which, you know, is not his, you know, idea of, you know, what he's probably used to, but he just wanted to learn from Lilo. And I think, you know, that's why he has so much respect for him now.
Yeah, the stories are as well that the players really like him as well, and that's been one of the kind of unifying factors of the season. Support for the Blue Moon podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped just launched their fourth-generation trimmer, the Lawnmower 4.0. You heard that right, 4.0. Join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer. 20% off and free shipping worldwide with the code BLUEMOON at manscaped.com. Imagine shaving with a sleek, well-designed and optimized trimmer that makes shaving time your favorite time in the bathroom. Manscaped engineered the ultimate groin and body trimmer by focusing on intelligent functionality and an incredibly comfortable grooming experience. Their fourth generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce accidents, helped by their advanced skin-safe technology. The upgraded trimmer also includes a multifunction on-off switch that can engage a travel lock. It also gives you the ability to turn the 400K LED spotlight on and off when needed for a precision shave. The Lawnmower 4.0 even allows you to customize your trim through additional guard lengths with sizes 1 to 4. The new wireless charging system uses electromagnetic induction, which can help the battery last even longer. So it's time to get your own ball hair and body trimmer with Manscaped to make me time the best time and enhance your confidence. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code BLUEMOON at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping to anywhere in the world at manscaped.com with the code BLUEMOON. Blue Moon. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. I mean, one of the other factors is, I guess, the fact that Fernandinho's captain this season, because he's had a huge effect off the pitch, hasn't he?
Yeah, from talking to people at the club, they sort of recognised that Fernandinho was absolutely, you know, he's really, really proud to get that captaincy when he was voted for by the rest of the squad at the start of the season. I mean, I personally, I remember at the time thinking, oh, De Bruyne is probably going to get this, you know what I mean? But they voted for Fernandinho, and he was absolutely, you know, gobsmacked, really, and happy that he got the vote, and he's taken it, the responsibility, very seriously indeed. And I think he's a, you know, popular member of the squad, and he's also very popular amongst the kind of senior players, the other senior players, because he involves the rest of the leadership group in the decisions that he makes. So De Bruyne, Gundogan, Sterling and Walker, they're the guys who make up the senior leadership group. And he involves them in everything that he does, you know, the decisions he makes and et cetera. So he's a very good kind of delegate, I think, in terms of, you know, help, asking other people to help him out. He doesn't take everything on himself. And he's really helped. If you look at people like Zinchenko, he's been really helpful towards him as well, because he speaks Russian after his time in Shakhtar, obviously. So I think he recently called him like his dad in Manchester. So he's had a huge impact. And you know, when company left, they really needed someone else to step up. And I thought actually last season he did a decent job playing at centre half. I know other people thought otherwise, but I thought he was one of City's better defensive performers. But you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he played him in the Champions League final after his performance against PSG. He's still got that knack of committing those fouls and, you know, breaking up attacks and putting his head in where he knows it'll get hurt. So he's been a really good appointment as captain, definitely.
Yeah. One final thing, Paul, is I just want to play this from Guardiola on basically how he keeps motivating the team when it's won nearly everything time and again, how he keeps getting the best out of them.
It's so addictive to win. Win is so nice. You sleep better, you eat better, you laugh more. Everything is better. Why should I stop when we still we can do it? Why should not try to win again when still we can do it? Why should not improve our game plan or our game when we can do it? Because from outside, got the results, but on the pitch today, I see the training, I see things I still I don't like. And that makes you do it. When you had the feeling that it's enough, that the pleasure to win another Premier League don't make you feel something special, and after is the moment to say bye-bye.
So, I mean, when you hear him talk like that, like what can possibly come next? I know the Champions League is still to play this season, but what could he achieve with this side in the next couple of years?
I think it's strange saying this now because they're obviously been played so well this season, but I still think they're sort of playing in third gear at the moment. I think if they signed a world-class left-back and if they signed a world-class centre-forward, then they would be, you know, they could get up to kind of like world domination kind of level where, you know, you win Champions Leagues year after year. And win the Premier League and retain it every year. I think that is what excites him. That's what excites, you know, the fans, I guess, that they could go on and kind of dominate. Because if you look at the other clubs at the moment, they're all kind of in different stages of transition. You know, United still aren't the finished product, and Solskjaer's got quite a lot of players from previous regimes who don't fit in with his kind of style of play. You've got Tuchel's only a few months into his reign, and you know Liverpool certainly need a bit of a churn in terms of their personnel. So City are the most solid you know team at the moment with the kind of best foundations of all the kind of top four or five teams. So it's not beyond them if they spend well this summer to really kind of assert their dominance over Europe and the Premier League over the next few years. And you know, like he says, he's addicted to winning, isn't he? He won't be kind of settled on the fact that they've won the Premier League and the Carabao Cup this year. He wants to win the Champions League, and next year he'll want to win it again. So as long as he's got that fire inside him, I just think he'll want to carry on winning, you know, in such a relentless fashion over the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, the final question, Paul, I know this is, it's only a couple of, well, it's only a few months ago that he signed his contract extension, but he's never going to get it better than anywhere else at City. We've seen the support that he has from Caldoun and the hierarchy at City. Is there a chance that this is, that we're talking dynasty territory here, where he can go on and just continue and continue at City until he's had enough?
It's kind of difficult one to answer it without kind of delving into his mind. But I think the main thing is that he's very happy in Manchester. He's happy with how, with his relationship with the board, as we've spoken about before, and the fact that there's no meddling in what he does at City. You know, what Pep says goes, basically. It's not like Barcelona, where you've got presidential elections, and Bayern Munich, where you've got, you know, legends kind of chipping in the media saying this, that, and the other about his management style or whatever. He's very happy with the setup here, and he's very very settled. I think the biggest factor will be whether the players get tired of him. I know that's that might seem a bit strange, given that they enjoy success clearly and want to win every trophy going. But I always remember an interview with Kyle Walker a couple of years ago, where he was asked to sum up what it's like being a player under Pep Guardiola in one word, and he said intense. So, you know, if that kind of carries on for the next few years, and the players, you know, maybe kind of get a bit tired of him, that's what Pep will be on the lookout for. But I certainly don't see that coming at the moment. You know, the bounce after the new contract says, prove that, you know, that they're still very much with him and enjoy playing under him. So I think that'll be something that Pep will be looking out for. But I think for now, I think he's certainly definitely going to see out the final 2 years of his contract. And, you know, who knows what might come after that.
For a pledge of $2 a month, you can hear our weekly bonus show on a wide range of City topics. There's more details on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Paul Hurst talking to me about the key moments of this season. Time to finish with Ask the Panel. Get the questions in for next week on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast or through the website bluemoonpodcast.com. Robert Breen is first up on the emails. He says, how is it fair that City fans are expected to pay over £500 for tickets to the Champions League final when there's been no certainty over where it was going to be played for so long? We've known the finalists for weeks, we've known the situation in Turkey for longer, and the prices were only released on Wednesday. How do UEFA have the balls to say that football is for the fans? Jack, what do you make of that?
That's just how much Category 1 tickets cost, isn't it, at UEFA finals, which is an absolute joke. It's a complete joke. And the problem with that is that there will be some people that have the disposable income to be able to afford it, which is great, but there are other people that will feel desperate to go, quite rightly, because they want to go and watch the club in a final, but then see the other categories all sell out and then overstretch themselves because they're so desperate to go, which is just so unfair. I mean, no normal supporter that isn't faffing about in corporate boxes or whatever should have to pay £500 to go and watch a football game.
Yeah.
Just like, it's just, it doesn't even need anyone. Doesn't need me or anyone else to say that. It's just a nonsense. But unfortunately, that's how much it costs, and that's how much it costs for a long time to get in the Category 1 seats, which I presume are just like, I don't know, on the halfway line, are they, in the first tier? What can you say? That's what football is now.
The location of the final has been an absolute joke as well. I mean, you go back to before the PSG second leg. Everyone knew the situation in Turkey. They knew that COVID was rising and there was a potential for an All England final. Why they weren't talking about moving this game to the UK? You know, I understand, you know, it's not, obviously it's a European final. You want to try and have a European destination, but, you know, for God's sake, it's the middle of a COVID pandemic.
It's not a normal year, is it? That's the point, yeah.
But we just don't want thousands of people going all over Europe. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And then the length of time to sort it out was just crazy. Just get it moved to Cardiff or Wembley or Glasgow or whatever. Just ludicrous. I appreciate it would have been better if it had been a European opposition in the final and a European city for the final, which it still is. But in this time, you know, we've all had this ridiculous 12 months, and it's just no one seems interested in the common sense answer to what should have been an easy decision.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of this, Jack, is, as you say about the ticket prices, there is at least a small consolation for City fans that their flights and the PCR tests are being covered by the club, because, Chelsea fans haven't got that luxury right now.
Yeah, it's a really, really good thing that the club have done. I didn't realise they were also paying for the PCR tests, which is a big thing. You have to praise them for that. It's fantastic. I don't know what the score is when those fans get to Portugal. I don't know whether they're then kind of herded towards fan parks and straight to the ground, or what time the flight's going to be, how many flights there are going to be. But that kind of feeds into the whole, and this isn't City's fault, but feeds into the whole shambolic nature of the organisation.
Yeah, I mean, the other side, I don't even know if you're able to travel to this game not on an official package. You know, make your own way there.
I'm sure I read the other day there's a small number of tickets available to people that are making their own way there. But I mean, like, everyone was so giddy and they were all booking the flights and whatever, weren't they? As soon as it became clear it was going to be Porto, people quite rightly got flights and hotels if they wanted to go. And then they're being told, well, you can have it for free, and it's like, well, what do I do? It's just been a complete mess. And I'd love to have known what the conversations were, what was said in the conversations between the government and UEFA about Wembley, because the EFL, I think, we're going to happily move the playoffs from Wembley to allow UEFA to hold it there. And then the kind of idea after the event was that the government didn't want to allow certain kind of, or a massive volume of VIPs to come over that UEFA kind of wanted and said they had to come. Now, I don't know whether UEFA have, this is me speculating completely, but I don't know whether UEFA have kind of chanced their arm a little bit and asked for more than they would do initially, because actually they didn't want the game in London at all.
Well, there was the theory that it was a political decision, wasn't there, to red list Turkey in the end, to make sure that to bring the game to the UK, which I think UEFA were a little bit concerned about.
So it's just that it's just been... the 2 weeks before the final should have been all excitement, and everyone just like looking forward to the occasion, because it's mattered, like... People at the club have said, haven't they? It's the biggest game in the club's history. Like, you can want to win the Premier League more than anything else, but that doesn't mean that the European Cup final isn't the biggest game that they've ever taken part in. And instead, the 2 weeks running up to it has just been basically thousands of people turning around going, what the hell's going on?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's finish on a positive note, because Sean Pickles on Twitter has asked, who is your pick for Player of the Year, Diaz, Gundogan or Mahrez? And obviously the news this week has been that Diaz has won the Football Writers Player of the Year. John, who would you pick of those three?
Yeah, really difficult. I mean, De Bruyne was in the top three for the FWA, but I would have to go for Ruben Diaz because of what he's done in transforming the defence. You know, his impact has kind of turned around the season. You go back to that Leicester game, they lost 5-2. He just really steadied the ship. His organisation, just the way that he's brought back that love of defending. He's inspiring in the dressing room. He's just been an absolutely fantastic sight. You know, and also, he's a good defender as well. He's just kind of been the full package. In turn, you know, it was 18 months after... No, it wasn't quite 18 months, was it? But since Vincent Kompany left, there's just a huge hole in the City defence. Well, in fact, in the whole team, just missing that leadership, that organisation and that spirit which he's brought and turned the season around and turned it into what has become a comfortable title-winning season.
Yeah, Jack. Any word for Gundogan or Mahrez that could even get close to Diaz for you?
No, they've both been exceptional in kind of moments of the season, but Diaz has been the full package from start to finish. It's amazing. Like he's only the third player to win that FWA award. He's only the third one that's won it in his first season in England, behind Klinsmann and Gianfranco Zola. And to then to do that as a defender, and a defender hasn't won it since 1989.
Yeah.
It's just like, everything's already been said about him, but the guy's just like a machine. He's like having a Terminator in your back four, isn't it? It's like, he's just, I remember interviewing him in January. I was lucky enough to interview him over Zoom, and he was just like, flipping out. I was like, he's 24 now. I can't believe I'm talking to a 23-year-old the way he's talking about defending and like leadership. And it was like talking to someone who'd been playing professional football for 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's little wonder that people at the club think that he's a captain in the future if he stays at the club, because he just pulls other people along with him.
I'm not going to lie. It's when you see that sort of thing from 23, 24-year-olds, Jack, that makes me feel almost inadequate as a 33-year-old, because I'm not sure I could sit there and give that interview. Do you know what I mean? I don't feel like I have that personality.
I felt like the junior interviewing him, which I was like, oh God, what am I doing in my life?
What are you doing with your life, Jack?
I don't really know, mate, to be honest. Kind of talking about how good footballers are that are kind of 7-10 years younger than me.
I didn't mean to pass on my existential crisis onto you, Jack. I do apologise.
Yeah, I'm kind of lost for words now, a little bit speechless. I'm going to have a long, hard think after this.
Yeah, right. Well, I tell you what, I'll end the show there. That'll make us all feel a bit better, I reckon. That's it for today's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests, Gold.com's Jonathan Smith.
Cheers.
And the Daily Mail's Jack Gaunt.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Feel better soon, mate. If you'd like to hear some more, then we're talking about the best meaningless consolation goals that City have scored over on our Patreon show. You can get that by signing up to any of the tiers on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. You also get ad-free versions of the podcast each week, too. Don't forget to leave us a rating and a review in all the usual places, and join us next week as we look ahead to the Champions League final. See you then.
Was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.